Let's continue on here and maybe hopefully wrap this up today. Be ready to dive into Mark on Wednesday. We're dealing here with the literary considerations in the book as to why Mark wrote the way he did. And we point out some pretty obvious facts. And some of these facts are, you know, so simple that you could, if you read Greek, you could read it through in the Greek and see a lot of this. And some of them, we were looking on break, some of the earlier versions of the New American Standard, I use the 95 version because it smooths a lot of this out. They don't translate the chi a lot. The earlier versions apparently did. We were down to subpoint H here under Roman numeral 5. A final literary consideration is the ending of the book. There are four alleged endings, but there is sufficient evidence that verses 9 through 20 are not to be treated as part of the original text. As we pointed out, a similar incident occurs in the Gospel of John there, where Jesus, and it's one of the verses, you know, that's quoted the most by people, and yet it's not a part of the original. John 7:53 through 8:11 is in brackets in my version, and it should be in brackets in your version because it doesn't exist in the original. So this was one of the ones, he who is without sin among you, let him be the first one to throw a stone. One of the verses that's quoted the most actually is not a part of the original Greek text. So these verses are not inspired. Now, did a situation or an event like this occur? Possibly, we don't know. But we do know that the text is spurious here. And the same is true at the end of the Gospel of Mark. When you get into the last chapter, verse 15, or pardon me, 16, mine, beginning with verse 9, has a bracket through the end of it. And there are very many, well, there's a number of alleged endings, but we'll see that, one, here the vocabulary and style is not that of John Mark. And then, two, the connection between verse 8 and 9 is awkward, to say the least. They went out and fled the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had gripped them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now, after he had risen on the first day of the week, he appeared to Mary Magdalene. Well, why single her out, and why this emphasis? Well, the fact is, the last 12 verses, point 3, are missing from many ancient manuscripts. And then, 4, several of the early church fathers, Clement, Origen, Eusebius, and Jerome, show no knowledge of the existence of these verses, which suggests at a bare minimum that they weren't part of the original, and so we will not deal with those verses. And of course, this is where some of the nut jobs actually take their theology from, a section of the scripture that's not even a part of the original. So they justify snake handling and all sorts of weird stuff in the name of religion. And the fact is, these verses, we won't even deal with them. So Roman numeral 6, occasion and purpose. Since a good number of interpreters date Mark after 60 A.D., some even as late as the 2nd century, when in fact I would lean much more towards a date between 55 and 60, the prevailing view is that Mark wrote during a time of increasing Roman persecution, which accounts for the emphasis on suffering found within the gospel. Well, B, however, since it can be demonstrated that Mark wrote before 60 A.D., the persecutions under Nero had not begun. So the real serious persecution hadn't begun. But had persecution begun? And the answer is yes. But again, the emphasis in Mark's gospel is on the servant of God. There's Jesus as the servant of God. And hence the great amount of emphasis on the action of what goes on, of the events that took place. And the suffering servant is brought out very much, the servant of Isaiah chapter 53. That prophecy is brought out towards the end of the book. So, nevertheless, various forms of persecution of the Jews had already begun during the reign of Claudius, when he ordered all Jews out of Rome in 49 to 50 A.D. One, Suetonius, says that the expulsion was caused by a series of disturbances due to the action of Crestus. In all probability, this Crestus must be interpreted as the leader of the Crestians. And this was one of the, we know, an early name that believers were called was Christians. So, too, this was likely the result of Christians encountering opposition from other Jews in Rome as they declared that Jesus was the Messiah. And we know that whenever they did have sizable Jewish populations, there was always conflict with the Jews over this issue, because the same conflict that exists between negative and positive volition at all times exists at that time as well. And the gospel was a big deal during that time. Of course, this was brand new information. The world had not heard any of this before at large. And so the Jews were very hostile to this because they were very hostile to Jesus in the first place, the vast majority of the Jews. Now, the irony is, of course, that many of the Jews believed under the ministry of John. And many of them were converted at that time. And many more believed under the ministry of Jesus. But the reality is, of course, when you're dealing with believers, you have to recognize, just as we point out, that when you're dealing with unbelievers, the vast majority of the world out here is negative. They're not interested in the truth. There is a segment of people that are positive to the truth. It's a small segment. We're not told how the exact percentage is. This way is called broad, and many go that way. This way is called narrow, and few go that way. Well, even within this few down here, you have an even smaller portion that are actually positive to doctrine and that are going to continue to make the adjustments to God's plan. And that group is very small. Well, as you're going to have conflict. Number one, you're going to have conflict with this section out here because of the just inherent conflict that exists between those that are negative and those that are positive. Those that are a part of Satan's kingdom and those that are a part of God's kingdom. But you even have conflict within here. This is what people don't like. They say, well, we should never have any conflict with other believers. Hogwash. Believers advance so many stupid ideas out there sometimes. And I mean, in a cursory study, go out there and just check if you're interested and if you can swallow it and stomach it. The kinds of activities that are passed off in the name of Christianity and teaching of God's plan. And so there exists a certain amount of animosity, unfortunately. But it's real, and you have to be aware of this. Paul had this problem with other believers. We saw it there in the book of Acts with John Mark, the author of our gospel we're going to be studying. Paul was not going to put up with his nonsense. He put up with it once and he wasn't going to do it again. Now, does that mean God was finished with John or wrote him off? No. John actually apparently outgrew some of this stuff and grew up and matured and was quite helpful to Paul. Well, again, the Jews had this problem with Rome. And again, the suggestion is it was over Christianity, essentially, because the Jews would create problems for these believers that were announcing that Jesus was the Messiah. They ran Paul out of town on a number of occasions. They stoned him on other occasions. They had the apostles beaten, as we know, there in Jerusalem. And Paul himself was very highly involved in the persecution of Christians, as seen in Acts chapter 7 and 8. He was there when Stephen was stoned. He was giving hearty approval to all of this. And so there was this conflict that existed. And it spilled over and became known in culture and in society. Well, three, the manner in which the Romans treated the Jews would impact Christians, since Christianity was viewed as a sect of Judaism at that time. The Romans, basically, now, all government to some extent, whether people like it or not, the Romans called the Jewish religion a religio licita, which meant a bona fide religion. And the Romans they had religio illicita, other religions which they did not deem to be religions and they wouldn't tolerate in the empire. So the government itself, in that regard, dealt with cults and that sort of weird stuff, like people that were involved in child sacrifice. They didn't put up with that. They wouldn't just say, you can worship your God in any way you please. They didn't say that. So the Jews were a part of a religio licita. They were accepted as a normal Jew religion because they weren't weird. They worshiped God. They had their problems, but they weren't weird from the Roman perspective. And so in this, the Christians for a long time, for some time anyway, were just basically treated as a sect of the Jews and they were viewed as okay. Well, it became clear after a while that these two were not the same. And so attitudes towards Jews were not the attitudes towards Christians. Christians were singled out later on. And certainly under the reign of Nero, they were singled out. And other ones too, Domitian, Diocletian. Some Roman emperors were more notable for persecuting believers than others were. So again, while they kind of were okay with Rome because they were Jews, this conflict that existed between them pretty well told Rome after a point, these two are not the same. And so then they had to figure out how they were going to deal with Christianity. Was it going to be tolerated? Well, during the decade from 50 to 60 AD, persecution began to increase in the form of verbal slander, as many of the Romans viewed Christians as a threat. One, they were viewed as being disloyal to Caesar, since they spoke of another king that they worshipped. 1 Peter 2:13 through 17. And largely, the book of 1 Peter is a book on enduring suffering, and particularly undeserved suffering. And Peter strongly encourages believers, look, if you're going to suffer, you make sure you're suffering for the right reasons. And you don't make sure you're not suffering because you're an idiot and you bring it on yourself. But because they spoke of Jesus as being king, that he was the king of the universe, in fact, and that he was returning to establish his kingdom, well, you could see where the government might not care for that. And as it turned out, of course, he wasn't returning during their lifetimes. Were believers misguided early on in Christianity? I think they were. I think a whole bunch of them were expecting Jesus to establish the kingdom immediately. But they were expecting that at the first advent, too. And he didn't do it. Well, and so Peter tells them, 1 Peter 2:13, he says, submit yourselves. For the Lord's sake, to every human institution. And actually, it begins back in verse 12. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. So essentially, Peter teaches the same thing Paul does. There's no conflict here. You submit yourselves to the government, to every human institution, beginning with the king, the primary ruler, as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. In the establishment realm, the idea of evildoers here gets into the idea of criminal activity. We want a government, and Rome had a government, which basically punished criminals and rewarded the righteous, i.e. law-abiding citizens. And so he said, such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men, but do not use your freedom as a covering for evil. Use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all people. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the king. So too, as they separated themselves from Roman polytheism, this caused Romans to refer to them as atheists. And not because they thought that, you know, they didn't believe in all these gods that the Romans worshipped. And so therefore they were viewed with suspicion. And they would not participate in the cults that were so prevalent and the worship that went on in these pagan temples. Much of which was, you know, a debase to start with. And you get into a study of these cults of Diana and some of these other things. And they were heavily sexually oriented. They had the temple of prostitutes called Vestal Virgins. Ironically, were nothing more than just paid prostitutes. That's all they were. And that kind of religion appeals to some people. Let's go worship God, have sex, and go home. Well, some people like that. That's their view of God. Well, that appeals to a large segment of society that has a sexual lust grid. And not only am I right with God, but I get sex. Well, you can't beat that. You bring some crackers, you got a deal. Well, three, they were viewed as causing economic problems for those that profited from the worship of idols. Acts 19, we saw this conflict that erupted in Ephesus because of this very factor. And what is the real problem that unbelievers often have with Christianity? Some of it, frankly, unfortunately, all you got to do is follow the money. It impacts their pocketbooks. And they don't care for that. Acts 19:23, and about that time there occurred a no small disturbance concerning the way. Now that was another term they used to describe believers in Christianity, the way. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith, who made silver shrines of Artemis, was bringing no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with workmen of similar trades and said, "Men, you know that our prosperity depends on this business. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in most all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a considerable number of people, saying that gods made with hands are no gods at all." Well, that crazy guy. Well, of course they're not. Not only is there danger that this trade of ours falls into disrepute, well, people might start looking down on us, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis be regarded as worthless, and she whom all of Asia and the world worship will even be dethroned from her magnificence. Well, if your god can be dethroned, ain't much of a god. But, you know, don't let that bother you. And when they heard this, they were filled with rage, and they began crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And so the city is filled with confusion, and nobody knows what's going on. There's a riot, basically, erupts over what? Money. Christianity and money. Well, for when various disasters occurred, Christians were blamed for wars, storms, and diseases, since these were thought to be a demonstration of the anger of the gods. And, of course, you want to marginalize these people, and you want to have a scapegoat. And it's good to have a scapegoat when things go wrong. Blame believers. Well, it would seem that Mark was written during this time. And this gospel was designed to set forth the suffering servant in order to encourage believers to endure suffering and persecution for their faith appropriately. And there's a way to handle it and a way not to handle it. And unfortunately, a lot of it is you just have to absorb it and endure it. And that's the nature of undeserved suffering. If you just make sure, as Peter tells them, make sure that you don't bring it on yourself. As one considers the Gospels, it seems apparent that there was likely more than one single purpose for their composition. One, the early church seemed to have an eschatological outlook that viewed the return of Christ as being imminent. John 21, even at the end of John, verses 21 through 23. And did the church have to grow up and figure some things out? Yes, they did. They weren't just given all knowledge immediately. Nobody gets that. You have to, number one, if you're going to get the knowledge of God, you have to want it. You have to be positive. And you have to be consistent. You have to be, you got to want the truth. We call this being a seeker. But what passes off for seeking today very often isn't seeking at all. The casual seeker is promised nothing by God. The diligent seeker is promised the knowledge of God. So you got to be a positive believer. You have to be consistent in Bible class. You got to have the intake of doctrine on a consistent basis. Because, again, we say that the proof is in the details. The essence of Christianity is not found in the broad strokes. It's found in the minutiae at some level. And it's not minutiae in a bad sense. But so the early church, they didn't have a bunch of these things straight. They had to grow. And in order to grow, this involves putting together doctrines, starting with basic simple doctrines, A, B, C, and then factoring in more complicated doctrines. And this takes time. And if people aren't willing to put the time in, they come to Bible class. "I've been coming for 6 months. I should know it all now." No, it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way at all. Any more than you could go out and learn any discipline in 6 months. What are you going to learn? You think they'll let you be a doctor because you went to school for 6 months? I hope not. And yet we got people that take a year of Greek and think they're scholars and can study the Bible. No, it takes way more than that. Well, the early church had to figure certain things out. And one is that Jesus wasn't coming back quickly. But he had given them enough clues that they should have been able to figure this out. He said, you know, and in the parables, for instance, he always talks about a guy going on a journey for a long time. He doesn't say the guy went, you know, took a long weekend. He's gone long enough that he puts his servants in charge, and his absence is viewed as extended. Well, John 21, 21 through 23, so Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, talking about the disciple John, the author of this gospel, in fact, he said, "What about this man?" And Jesus said to him, "If I want him to remain until I come," i.e. until I return, "what is that to you? You follow me." Therefore, this saying went out among the brethren that that disciple would not die. In other words, Jesus' return was going to be within his lifetime. And that disciple was John. And so he says, yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but only, if I want him to remain until I come, what is that to you? And this is what I like to call the classic, I hear your words, but I don't understand what the hell you're saying. He wasn't saying John wouldn't die. He was saying, this is none of your business, Peter. This does not concern you. And then look in the book of Acts. And what are the disciples? What's their thinking immediately? Following, and this is just prior to the day of Pentecost. This is sometime during that 40-day period. So of Acts 1:6. So when they had come together, they were asking him, saying, Lord, is it at this time you are restoring the kingdom to Israel? And he said to them, it's not for you to know the times or the epochs which the Father has fixed by his own authority. God has a plan. And this plan is stretched out over a period of time, and there's a right time and a wrong time for everything. And essentially, the plan of God for humanity encompasses a period of about 7,000 years, 6,000 or so of which have already passed. And the thousand, the final thousand, is the millennium, where Jesus Christ bodily returns and rules the planet from Jerusalem. So that thousand, we got Adam back here, by my best estimation, at about 3960 AD from the biblical chronology. And so here we are at 2010. Well, that's the better part of 6,000 years. That's about 5,970 years right there. And so that points us to the fact that the rapture is imminent, that it has to be. We've got to subtract off another 7 years here for Daniel's 70th week, the final 7 years of that. Then you have to take off of that, and the rapture occurs right here, just prior to that, or in fact inaugurating that. So God waited almost 4,000 years before even sending his son into history. But once the word became flesh and dwelt among us, once the light came into the world, that changed everything. Now humanity's really on the hook. People can't claim ignorance. God has manifested himself in human history. Well, the church seemed to think, they kind of thought, in the beginning stages at any rate, well, we're not going to be here long. Jesus is going to come back and solve all this. Well, he didn't. And they began to figure out that he wasn't coming back quickly. It took them a while, but they did. Well, too, as it became apparent that Christ was not going to return shortly, believers would have been motivated to record the signs that he had taught them, so subsequent generations would be able to recognize them. Three, the apostles and other eyewitnesses of the incarnation were growing older, and James had already been martyred in 44 AD. That's recorded for us in Acts chapter 12. Now, about that time, Herod the king, this is not the Herod, this is another Herod, laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. And when he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now, that was during the days of unleavened bread. So, again, James, in the book of James, has to be the earliest one in the New Testament, because it's my contention he had to write it while he was alive. That afterward it would have been way more difficult. So James is the earliest book of the New Testament that was recorded. There's no evidence that there was anything written before that. Galatians is pretty early, but I don't think it's as early as James. So as churches were established around the Roman Empire, a need for written material became evident, since the apostles could only be in one place at one time and were already down to 11. And by the time 64 AD rolls around, another 20 years, Peter's gone. We don't know when the rest of them died. We're really not told. We do know that Peter died in about 64, and that Paul was dead by about 68, and that by 90 AD, John was the only apostle left. So clearly you can't have, you know, one guy responsible for the whole world. That doesn't work. So the apostles could only be in one place. Five, there would be a natural interest by new believers to know the events of Christ's life, which would be necessary if they were to follow in his steps. 1 Peter 2:21, Peter exhorts them to follow in the steps of Jesus. But how can you do that if you don't know how Jesus lived? And so it becomes pretty apparent, pretty early, that, look, we need some definitive works on this. 1 Peter 2:21, for you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. And Peter's exhorting them with respect to their sufferings, that bad things are going to happen. Well, six, since it would be apparent to any shrewd observer, Roman attitudes towards the Jews and Christians were getting worse. That was a fact. That began essentially in 49 AD, although Claudius had, he couldn't really fully enforce his edict for all Jews to get out of Rome. Because, you know, eventually at some point, you know, some would travel back in, not even being aware that they weren't supposed to be there. And then under Nero, persecution began in earnest, as Nero blamed the believers for the fire there in Rome. So Roman attitudes were changing. Christianity was no longer going to be tolerated, it was appeared. And so how are we going to, you know, keep track, essentially, of what all is happening? And seven, lastly, there would be apologetic reasons to distinguish Christianity from Judaism, to correct misconceptions about Christ during the early and rapid influx of heresies, and to evangelize and edify believers. And the fact is, the heresies, the heretical writings, began very early on. Satan didn't wait forever to try to infiltrate Christianity. He began to attack, and in some cases, as we saw there in the book of Acts, his largest attacks come from within, from believers that are going south spiritually. They may be believers, okay, but men like Hymenaeus and Alexander are dangerous. Men like Hymenaeus and Philetus are singled out in Scripture as being bad eggs. And you know what we do with bad eggs? We get rid of them. I don't keep them. I don't keep a bad egg in my refrigerator and think, I hope this becomes good. Maybe it'll change. No. And that's what Paul did. He just tossed them out finally because he said, you guys are bad eggs. And he threw them out. And people may not like that, but that's the reality of why we have authority within the church even. Because we don't have to just tolerate anybody and everybody. If people want the truth, fine, I'm all for them and you better be all for them. If they want to argue, if they want to debate, if they want to do this or that, they want to disrupt, they want to create strife and conflict, hit the road. Not interested in it. Don't need it. There are believers that want to learn the truth. And we're going to make and provide an environment in which they can do so. And we don't have to tolerate every Tom, Dick, and Harry that says he's positive. Now, if he is, fine, I'm all for him. I'm all for people. I mean, I devoted my life to this, for goodness sake. Why would I not want people to learn and grow? I do. But the question becomes, do they want to, really? Or are they just giving lip service to God's plan, all the while going around and undermining it with their other hand? And many, many believers are engaged in that. And they think they're fine with God. Well, we'll see at the bema seat. We'll find out. We're gonna get the truth on all this at some point. So again, these people, the Gnostic heresies arose pretty early on. They did not take forever to get going. And Paul talks about this in the book there of Acts when he said, I know that after my departure, men will rise up among you. Men from among you will rise up speaking perverse things. And guess what? The greatest enemies of Christianity are often believers that have gone negative. It's not the external world, oddly enough. It's believers that have gone south spiritually. They create more problems and more strife than unbelievers in large measure don't care. They don't care that we're out here meeting this morning. They don't care if we're studying the Bible. It doesn't bother them. But other believers, it bugs them to no end. Why? Well, they're hostile to God, unfortunately. And so that hostility is manifested in hostility towards his church sometimes. That's sad, but it's the way it goes. Well, Daniel Wallace, and I did cite this because I thought it was interesting, and I also think there may be some merit to it, provides another possible reason for the composition of the Gospel of Mark that merits some consideration. One, Mark wrote this Gospel as a prelude to Paul's intended visit to Rome. The evidence, though quite, and these are all his words. That's why I give you the footnote there. This is verbatim from his own stuff, his work. This isn't my. He says that he is speculating a little bit, but I've read through his thinking on this, and it does make some sense to me. Two, the church at Rome was established before the Jerusalem Council met in 50 A.D. A Suetonius statement that Claudius banned Jews from the Rome. From Rome in 49 to 50 because they rioted in reaction to Crestus. Probably, again, refers to the Jews' reactions to Christians in that city, and we know there was a lot of conflict during the first century. Three, the church was probably established shortly after Pentecost, since proselytes and Jews came from Rome to Jerusalem. That we know clearly from Acts 2:10. Of course, this was one of the pilgrim feasts, the three pilgrim feasts of the Jews, in which all male Jews were required to attend. Pentecost was one of those. And in fact, as we know, when they were speaking in tongues, the miracle was that they could all hear them in their own dialect. And it wasn't just, you know, and this tongues, of course, is not gibberish. The word tongues means known languages. Not as it's been distorted today by fringe groups claiming to be, you know, they're Christian, I guess, they're believers, but they got really weird ideas about tongues. Every place in here, in the book of Acts, you can translate the word tongues by languages, and you do no injustice to the context. So they were hearing all this, and they were puzzled. Why are not all these who are speaking Galileans? Verse 8, how is it that we each hear them in our own language, to which we were born? Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, and the districts of Libya around Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretan and Arabs. We hear them in our own tongue. People, Cretans are people from Crete, not Cretans, as we assume. Although, that term was stuck for a reason. Read the book of Titus. For the church would have been quite immature, since these converts had very little information about Jesus on which to base their lives. And when you read Paul's letter to the Romans, it is written in a step-by-step treatise, and he deals with things in great detail. Because they didn't have any real true foundation to speak of. They would have been believers up there without any real good leadership. They had some leadership. Whatever they had sort of naturally might have risen to the top, but none of the apostles had been there at this time that we know about. So, 5, even though Peter and Paul ended up in Rome in the early to mid-60s, we have no record of either of them getting there in the 50s. So, 6, it is very doubtful that any apostle founded the church at Rome. Now, we do know there was one there, but we don't know how it got started, and most likely it got started by these believers coming from these feasts and taking the word back with them. And of course, we did have, you know, the apostles were mobile, so it's not like they couldn't travel there. But we don't have any record of any of them getting there in the 50s. Now, they might have. But as we're going to see, Wallace's suggestion is that Mark was one of the primary ones that did get there. And that Mark had a great affinity for this church, and that he was heavily involved in this church. And that, given the fact that he's writing mostly, we can pretty well prove he's writing mostly to a Roman audience, all that to me makes sense. So Romans 15:20, and thus I aspire to preach the gospel, not where Christ was already named, so that I would not build on another man's foundation. And so he essentially said, I want to come to Rome to help establish you. That he says that in the early part of the book of Romans, recognizing that they needed some establishment and encouragement and these types of things. So it is very doubtful, again, that any apostle founded the church. 7, the combined evidence from Acts and the epistles suggests that although Mark was not in Paul's good graces in circa 50 AD, the time of the council meeting in Acts 15, he was so in 60 to 62. When Paul dispatched him to the Colossians Philemon from Rome. Philemon was a believer that was living there in Colossae. He was a part of that church. And those two books were written from Rome, and Mark, Paul says, if Mark comes, you welcome him. So, 8, thus sometime in the 50s, Mark certainly proved himself worthy of Paul's confidence once again. The fact that he is in Rome when Paul commends him may be no accident. 9, in Acts 19:21, Paul expresses his intention to visit Rome for strategic missionary work. Although it is impossible to date this precisely, it must have occurred in the early 50s AD. 10, further, this may not have been the first time Paul expressed such an intention, even though it is the first mentioned by Luke. Surely Paul's planned itinerary would be known to interested Christians in Jerusalem and Antioch. 11, one of the reasons why Paul wanted to go to Rome would have been the lack of apostolic guidance in that church. If the church was begun by proselytes returning from Pentecost in 33 AD, it would have only had hit or miss instruction about the faith for some time. Now we're in early 50s, we're talking about 17 years, apparently with no apostolic guidance. So And Paul's, again, right at the very beginning of Romans, if you look at the beginning of that book in chapter 1, he tells them why he wants to come. Verse 10, he says, "In my prayers making request, if perhaps now at last by the will of God I may succeed in coming to you. For I long to see you so that I may impart some spiritual gift," not a spiritual gift like you receive at salvation. Clearly, Paul is not the author of those. So this has to be, and by the way, this is the only place in the Bible where the Greek term spiritual gift is actually used. Other times it's just a form of charis, of grace gift. So that you may be established, i.e. built up in the faith. And I don't want you to be, verse 13, I don't want you to be unaware that I have often planned to come to you and have been prevented so far. So that I may, and see, this is where Paul's recognition, okay, God's timing is not in this right now. As a believer, you have to be sensitive to that, to God's timing in any matter. There's a right time and a wrong time. Many wrong times, in fact, if there's a right time. So I'm eager, of course, as he says here, so that I may obtain some fruit among you also, even as among the rest of the Gentiles. So 12, putting all this together, we see that there's a good bit of circumstantial evidence which suggests that someone from Paul's circles had penetrated Rome with the gospel before he wrote the book of Romans. And 13, further, there is independent evidence that Mark wrote his gospel in the mid to late 50s. Again, I don't think a date between 55 and 60 AD is problematic for this. 14, when considering the raison d'etre, that means, that's just a French term, that means reason or justification for something, for the production of this gospel, it is easy to see why Mark would be so highly motivated to get back into Paul's good graces and precede Paul to Rome. 15, all the data fit the supposition that Mark went to Rome in the early to mid-50s with Peter's sermons and Paul's mission in the back of his mind. 16, he then composed the gospel for the Roman Christians. In this light, it is no wonder that Mark's gospel looks so Pauline with respect to the Old Testament law, even though he got it from Peter in large measure. What we can say is, again, in the early 50s, Mark is on the outs with Paul, and everybody probably knows about this. Again, believers talk, you know, word spreads. And so Mark may be motivated to show Paul, I'm not a loser. I mean, you know, don't write me off quite yet. And this work in Rome would have been important, and Mark knew it was important to Paul. I mean, if he knew Paul, he knew this was important to him, that he wanted to get there. And that God's will eventually was for Paul to get to Rome. Now, Paul fouled up. If you study the book of Acts carefully, you see Paul gets out of fellowship, and instead of going to Rome where he's supposed to go, he goes to Jerusalem because he thinks he's going to win the Jews over. Well, guess what? He not only didn't win them over, he ended up going to Rome anyway on a prison ship. So he ended up in Rome anyway. But the journey was one hell of a deal. It wasn't fun. But that's the nature of divine discipline. Sometimes you get out of fellowship, you do something stupid, and it's not all fun and games after that. Well, 18, it has been recognized from the time of the early church fathers that there is a correlation between the four living creatures of Revelation and the fourfold presentation of Christ in the Gospels. One, Matthew emphasizes that Jesus is the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the expected king of the Jews, using the figure of a lion, that is. And if you look in the book of Revelation, actually, what we're talking about is in Revelation chapter 4, I believe. These four living creatures. And of course, anything God creates as a manifestation of himself at some level. That's why all of us are individuals. We're all unique. God didn't just make a whole bunch of robots. They were all the same, cookie cutters, any of that. Everybody is a unique individual. God is infinite, so he could theoretically be creating people to infinity if he wanted to. And everybody would be unique in that regard. Nobody would be the same. Even twins aren't exactly the same. They're more similar, say, than maybe you are with your brothers or sisters, but they're not identical in that sense. They're each their own person. So in Revelation chapter 4, Verse 6, and before the throne, he sees this throne, there was something that resembled a sea of glass, like crystal. And in the center and around the throne, there were four living creatures, full of eyes in front and behind. And the first, the eyes symbolize their great intelligence and also their view of history. That these creatures, while not omniscient, are able to see a lot of things, we might say, in the past and in the future even. They don't know everything. That's why they got eyes in front and behind. And the first creature was like a lion. The second creature like a calf. The third had a face like a man. And the fourth living creature was like a flying eagle. And those four creatures very much are seen in the gospel presentations by these four men. Matthew, he uses Jesus as the king, the lion, the king of the jungle. Two, this is one reason Matthew traces the genealogy of Christ back to King David, demonstrating that he has the legal right to the throne of Israel, and that he is the promised king that will fulfill the particulars of the Davidic covenant. Let's go to 2 Samuel 7:16 first, because that's where we get the idea here. This is where it's first introduced. 7:16, and David is told here, your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne will be established forever. In accordance with all these words and all this vision, so Nathan spoke to David. And then if you go into Matthew chapter 1, people, you know, they start reading the book and they think, well, why is this here? Well, everything's here for a reason. One, as I pointed out, these genealogies, not necessarily this one in the New Testament, but Old Testament genealogies are quite valuable in fixing chronological dates. So the record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham, and he traces his lineage down through David. And traces it down to, in verse 16, Jacob was the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah. The Messiah means Christos, the anointed one. And so this genealogy here documents that he's of that royal line. He has a right to the throne. And Luke's does too, as we'll see. Well, three, Mark's emphasis is seen in the second living creature, which resembled a calf, which is an animal that man has domesticated for his personal use. For this representation is designed to convey the spiritual truth that Jesus Christ was the servant of God. Isaiah 42:1. So thus fulfilling these Old Testament prophecies. Again, Mark's emphasis is a little different than Matthew's, and his audience is different. So we would expect there to be differences in the compositions. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him, and he will bring forth justice to the nations. And you don't have to be very much of a genius to read that there are three people that God's talking about here. His son, himself, and his spirit. The Trinity is found throughout, the doctrine of the Trinity is found throughout the Bible if one reads it carefully. Also 52:13. And as a matter of fact, at the outset there, at the Gospel of Mark, with the baptism of Jesus, all three members of the Godhead are manifest. The Father speaks, the Spirit descends like a dove in that theophany, and the Son is standing there. 52:13, that you have forgotten the Lord your Maker, who stretched out the heaven. Oops, I'm sorry, that's the wrong one. Let's try 13. Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. And this formed the problem, of course, for the Old Testament prophets, because they had all these prophecies that talked about the servant of God and this great glory that he was going to experience. And then they had all these prophecies that talked about his suffering. And they couldn't recognize, they couldn't reconcile the concept of a suffering Messiah and a glorious Messiah. Why? Well, the fact is, they didn't understand the two advents. The first advent was for suffering. The second advent is going to be for glory. And that's where, and again, in between these things, there's a period of time, like 2,000 years. And so the prophets couldn't see this. They knew something was up in there, but they couldn't tell you exactly what it was. So 52:13 and then 53:11. as a result of the anguish of his soul. He will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many. He will bear their iniquities, and therefore I will allot him a portion with the great. In other words, Jesus, SG3 and all of this, his eternal rewards are going to blow people away. In fact, he has the greatest package of rewards that anybody's ever going to have. He is exalted with a name, a reputation that's superior to everybody else's. No matter whoever lives or whoever has lived, Jesus is far greater than they are. And five, this is the emphasis of the Gospel of Mark, which provides no genealogy or personal information about him, since it would not be fitting to delineate the history of a slave. Six, the third living creature is described as having a face like that as a man, which emphasized the true humanity of Jesus Christ. Psalm 8, which for some reason not too many people have identified as messianic, but it certainly is messianic. Because this provides for you the fact that God's plan always was, even though Satan set up his kingdom here on planet Earth and God had to eject him, is that it's always been God's plan for man to rule over his creation, not angels. Always man. What is man that you take thought of him, and as a son of man that you care for him? Yet you have made him a little lower than God. And you crown him with glory and majesty. You make him to rule over the works of your hands, and you put all things under his feet. And this is, again, messianic, referring to Jesus himself. He's the ultimate fulfillment of this. Well, seven, this is clearly one of Jesus Christ's favorite designations for himself, as evidenced by the fact that it is used some 84 times in the gospel accounts. Eight, this aspect of his character emphasizes the reality that God would become flesh and take all the limitations of humanity upon himself in order to redeem the fallen race. Hebrews 2, 14 through 18. And again, when we think of Jesus, when we deal with this, and we'll deal with the doctrine of the hypostatic union and kenosis and all these associated doctrines, it is not as though Jesus is just a human indwelt by God. He's fully human like you and I are. He has a body, a soul, and a spirit. And he had his own mentality. Now, he recognized that within himself there were two distinct consciousnesses. The consciousness of God and his conscience, his own consciousness. And these two were not always in sync. Now, Jesus always synced himself to the will of God. But we see, for instance, there in the Garden of Gethsemane, he said, "Not my will, but your will." Indicating that there's a bit of a conflict here. Why? Because Jesus didn't want to go to the cross and die. He didn't want to endure all that. In his humanity, he shied away from that, much as anybody would. No, if you knew that what kind of death that was, that entailed. But yet he always humbled himself and always opted for the will of God in every situation. That is part of his greatness as just a human being. And people have complained that Jesus, it was impossible for him to sin. No, it wasn't. He was tempted, as a matter of fact, that's our verse here, for 14, since the children share in flesh and blood. He himself also likewise partook of the same, that through death he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and might free those who through the fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. For assuredly he does not give help to angels. In other words, there's no salvation for angels. Satan and the third of the angels that fell never have a shot at being saved. Because they've committed the unpardonable sin. They've exercised unbelief in the face of God. Essentially, they had to opt for God didn't create us. And then once they went down that path, they're not going to turn back. Nor, that's why salvation is not provided for them, nor their volition is such that they don't want to. Satan is what he is. And he's created his own, he's creating his own destiny. But he created it when he exercised unbelief in the face of God. In the very face of the presence of the one who created him, he said, "I don't buy it." Well, okay. So there's no salvation for angels, if you ever hear any of that nonsense. There's not. But he does give help to the descendant of Abraham. Therefore, he had to be made like his brethren in all things, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest. Merciful in that he knows what it's like to be tempted. He knows what we go through. He's endured it. And very often in worse situations than we find ourselves, with greater hostility. and a faithful high priest, that is, he intercedes for us with the Father, in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For since he himself was tempted in all which he has suffered, he is able to come to the aid of those who are tempted. And so, the fact is, Jesus was tempted in all things. Now, some people say, they get into this deal, well, Jesus was tempted, but he couldn't have sinned. Yes, he could have. Of course he could have. If you're tempted, you can sin, can't you? You're a human being. And of course, you can also resist temptation. See, being tempted in and of itself is not a sin. So again, he had to become fully human and take on himself those limitations. Now, he's still God. He's got the consciousness of God in here. And so when you study the person of Jesus Christ, as we're going to, you have to account for everything in any passage. You have to ask yourself, is this true of his deity? Is this true of his humanity? Or is it true of both? And there's always an answer for that. When Jesus said, I thirst on the cross, that wasn't his deity talking. God doesn't get thirsty. When Jesus slept in the boat, God wasn't asleep. You have these things. Then you have him say, if I ascend back to where I was before, are you going to freak out? Well, that's not his humanity. That's his deity talking. His humanity was not in heaven prior to the incarnation. He was born with all the limitations, of course, that we have. So 9, in that regard, Luke traces Jesus' genealogy back to the original Adam. In Luke 3:23, you see there that he takes this all the way back to Adam to prove his true humanity. That's his purpose in writing. Luke 3:23, now I'm not going to read that whole deal, but actually the key verse is 38. And the son of Enosh, the son of Seth, the son of Adam, the son of God. God created Adam, as we know. So 10, the fourth and final living creature is said to resemble a flying eagle, which is known for its freedom, Obadiah 1:4, its keen sight, omniscience, its quick action, Jeremiah 48:40, its protectiveness, Deuteronomy 32:11, and whose coming is often a biblical figure for judgment. And that's one of the things we see, that when Jesus comes into the world, there's a judgment that falls on the human race, because now they're judged by what they do with the light. When the Word becomes flesh, it changes everything. And the human race is now on the hook. So 11, this serves as an extremely, you can see those verses there, Deuteronomy 28:49 and Job 9:26. And I probably shouldn't have said omniscience there. I probably should have said knowledge, because the keen sight is being able to see things actually. 11, this serves as an extremely, extremely fitting figure to represent the one on the throne as eternal God, and that his son shares equally in his deity. And then quickly here, the outline, I'm not going to outline the whole book. It's 15 chapters, 16 chapters, and it moves from event to event, so there's so many events that an outline would take as long to, it would be pages and pages. So as many have observed, the Gospel of Mark can be divided into two halves. The first half deals with Jesus' ministry in Galilee, that's up through 8:21, while the second half deals with his work in Judea, which ultimately, of course, culminates in Jerusalem. Jay, the first half emphasizes Jesus as the servant of the Lord, while the second half focuses on Jesus as the suffering servant. And Kay, within this broad outline, there are six major sections within the book. One, the first major section deals with the work of Christ in Galilee up through 6:6. Two, the second major section deals with his withdrawal from Galilee, which is based on the unbelief that was manifested toward him. And this is one of the things that we'll see in the life of Christ. He also was a bit of a no-nonsense guy. If they were going to exercise unbelief and reject the plan of God, he said, dust the shoes off, get the dust off your feet and go on to the next town. But don't sit here and try to win a bunch of numbskulls that aren't interested. He told his disciples not to even do that. And when they manifested his high degree of unbelief, because Jesus was, as we will find out, from this little podunk backwater little town in West Texas, in Galilee. But it was just like any other little small town. Everybody knew everybody's business. People were involved. They knew who Jesus was. They'd watched him grow up. And so they're not impressed, because they've seen him. And they think he's just a man. Well, the third major section deals with Jesus' revelation of his servanthood and the reality of the cross. That's a very short section, actually, just in Mark 8:22 through 38. for the fourth major section deals with Jesus' journey to Jerusalem. Boy, that didn't do too good there. Journey is not spelled right. Which will culminate in his death. And that's Mark 9, 1 through 52. And then the fifth major section records the ministry of Jesus in Jerusalem, leading up to the crucifixion. And that's 11, 1 through 13, 37. And then I don't know what happened here. My whole outline's gone nutty, but it should be ABC, and then it should be some point 6, but whatever happened there, that's the word processor. I clearly did not do that. The final section deals with the greatness of the suffering servant as evidenced by his death, burial, and resurrection, and that takes us through the end of the book. And I will be sending out the first probably 16 or 18 pages of Mark today or tomorrow, so you will need those by Wednesday, so please have that printed out. Thank you, Father, for this time together. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls and give us greater appreciation for what we are about to study with this understanding, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.